Well, good morning. My name is Zach Zamora, and in the 7 years I've pastored my church, I've never started close to on time, but they tell me that I'm supposed to start on time for this gathering because we have an hour together. So we're just a couple minutes late, which is early for me. I pastor a multi-ethnic, multilingual church in Logansport, Indiana, which is kind of the center of the world, so I'm sure most of you know where Logansport is. Probably not, but I'll show you later. I'll share more about my story later in the presentation, but just to give you a feel for what's going to happen today, I'm going to share a little bit about just migration, diaspora type stuff, so if you're not aware, you have a little more awareness there, a little bit of a biblical perspective of why I think we are called as followers of Jesus to welcome immigrants and refugees. Share a little bit about my story and some reflections. While I direct Immigrant Connection and I'm approved by the Department of Justice to practice immigration law, this workshop isn't about how to open an Immigrant Connection office, nor is it kind of focusing on the intricacies of immigration law. If you have questions like that, I'm around and we'll have questions later in the session. So if you came wondering about that dynamic that I'm involved in, glad to share, but they asked me to share at the gathering more about how we as individual pastors can flourish if we kind of move outside of our homogeneous unit and develop relationships with people that are different than us, immigrants and refugees. And so that's what I'll talk about. One final note and introduction, if you haven't noticed yet, I'm a white male. And while I'm a third generation, kind of a 2.5 immigrant from Poland. My grandfather and grandmother immigrated from Poland and Slovakia. The reality is I come from a place of power and privilege. And so I'm up here sharing just from my experience, the mistakes I've made, the things that I've learned in this journey that I've been on. And so a lot of you have more to offer, which is why we'll have some Q&A and allow you guys to share a little bit as well about what your journeys look like and what you've learned. So if you are an immigrant or refugee in this room, like the reality is you have a whole different perspective on this topic that you can share and that you need to be empowered to share. And so I won't share your story for you. I'll just kind of share my own. When I teach about the movement of peoples, I often utilize this image. This is an image that helps us understand. This is migration in the past 3 years. And the reality is it's from everywhere to everywhere. I think a lot of times North America and Europe acts like we are accepting all of these migrants. And if at one time, 100 years ago, that might have been the case, that there were sending nations, there were middling nations, and there were receiving nations, the reality right now is that people are on the move in the world. 1 in 30 people in the world today lives in a different place than the place they were born. 1 in 30. There are about 250,000 international migrants, which if you put them all in one nation, that would be the fifth largest country in the whole world. The reality is this has grown year over year. It increased 17% even last year. I can share this graphic with anyone that likes to, but like the reality is you'll see the people who leave are the lines that are closest to the bar, and where they go to are the arrows that are farthest. So I like to share with people in North America that we have people who are leaving North America, not all that are coming. You'll even see a light blue that there's a lot of people from North America that are returning to Latin America and the Caribbean. And so this idea that is perpetuated a lot of times that like we're receiving everyone isn't quite the case. The reality, like I shared, is 1 in 30 people are on the move. Mostly it's within regions. So Eastern Europe and Central Asia would be like Russia and Eastern Europe, and it's like you move within. Even within Europe, people are displaced within Europe, within Africa. You're moving from country to country based on what's happening there. It's not necessarily across massive regional sweeps. The other thing that is completely different in our world today that would even be unique from 10 years ago, is that the number of people that are forcibly displaced has moved up. One person every 2 seconds is forcibly displaced in our world today, which is why we have so many refugees, which is why we have so many people who are moving. And forcible displacement is primarily because of wars, many of which, if we're not involved in within the United States, we don't necessarily hear about, but people are continually forcibly displaced. So migration is from everywhere to everywhere. This is the United States population as a percentage of foreign-born, so the foreign-born population. So the reason why this should matter to you personally as a pastor or a pastoral leader or a spouse in your church is we have never seen our demographics in our communities so radically different. Like if you came into pastoring in the 1970s to the 1990s, that was the lowest percentage of foreign-born. And so unless you were pastoring, which I doubt many of you were, in 1910, the world we now live in is dynamically different when it comes to immigrants and refugees in a way that we haven't seen in a century. So right now, as of last year, 13.7% of the United States is made up of the foreign-born population. The last time we were even close to that was in 1910, when it was 14.7%. 45 million people are foreign-born in the United States. And I use certain words like migrants and foreign-born because a lot of times those words help us kind of not put immigrants in silos where we'd say these are like the citizens, these are the undocumented, these are foreign-born just as all immigrants, all those that have been born somewhere else and moved here and call this place their home now. So if you haven't already realized, your neighborhood has changed pretty dynamically. This is immigrant population growth in the past 6 years. My state of Indiana increased 16%. Like if you live in one of these darker, there's some big growth changes. There's a few states, like if you're from Alabama, Mississippi, where you've seen a decrease in immigrants, but most states have had these radical increases. The other thing that is unique, and if you're in a place like me, I think at one time we thought immigrants and refugees come to large areas. And so it was the refugee resettling places. Like you would think, of course, you know, New York and Los Angeles and Atlanta and a place like Orlando would have large numbers of immigrants. But I live in a city that's less than 20,000 and one third of my population is immigrants. And so it doesn't matter anymore if you're urban or rural. There was a time, especially in the 90s, where most immigrants came and they lived in large cities. And so those of us that were in rural areas or farm towns was like, well, this isn't really an issue for us. You know, we're primarily homogeneous. Most of us, I remember I grew up in a city, and since my grandparents immigrated from Poland and Slovakia, we knew all the neighborhoods were divided in Youngstown, Ohio. Like here's where the Polish live, here's where the German live, here's where the Irish live, the Italian. And so I knew my identity, like, as an immigrant. Where my wife grew up in Indiana, so I remember asking her on her first date, like, well, kind of where do you come from? And her answer, like most people that live in the farmlands of Indiana, was like, well, I'm an American. And I'm like, well, no, but like, you're probably not like First Nation. You're probably not Native American. Where'd you come from before that? It was like, well, no, I'm just American. And so like, that was the identity. Like for a lot of these places where we have this drastic immigration growth is that for the longest time, it was like all we've known is kind of homogeneous. My high school had, you know, no person of color in my graduating class. That was kind of the story. And yet in the past number of years, we've seen this radical change. So all that's just a little bit, and most of you know this because, like, wherever you go shopping, you have seen a change probably with the number of people who might look different than you or speak a different language that are at your Walmart or wherever you go shopping, and you've noticed how your neighborhood has changed. Just a little bit on a biblical perspective, just so that we can kind of root this with what Jesus would want us to kind of focus on today. And we could talk for hours about this, but the reality is immigrants are throughout the pages of scriptures. Like most of our heroes are immigrants or refugees. The Old Testament specifically talks a lot about the quartet of the vulnerable. My guess is if you're in this room today, you have an idea of that, that time and time again in the Old Testament, God says that his people, those that follow him, should care specifically for the widow, the orphan, the poor, and the foreigner living among you. That fourth category is specific to Judeo-Christian thought. All ancient peoples in the ancient Near East, the king was called to stand in the gap and care for the widow, the orphan, and the poor. That was normal. You didn't have to follow Yahweh to be called to that. But it was with an only Jewish thought that that fourth was added that said, no, that part of your identity should be how you welcome, care for, serve, learn from the foreigner living among you. So that's throughout the pages of the Old Testament. Matthew 25 is a place we go to a lot where it says, and I know, I mean, those of you that are multilingual know this better than anyone, that like sometimes translations just don't cut it. When I first came to pastor at the Bridge, we were a small church that was supposed to close. That was the goal. We were on the short list that I came to close it. And I did this whole series on underdog. Well, if you're a Spanish speaker in this room, you know that the idea of underdog is translatable, but there's no one word for an underdog. So in the back, Nico's like, no, what are you doing? Like, you keep using this word. Like, it just doesn't, I can't just say it like that. Well, Matthew 25, you probably know that verse where it says, when I was a stranger, you welcomed me. But like, the word is xenos. It's like a foreigner, an immigrant. So sometimes when we hear it as English speakers, especially as someone who's white, like a stranger, I just think it's like someone I don't know who's like me. But it's calling us to more than that. It's calling us to say how we welcome foreigners and immigrants is how we should welcome Jesus. And so it's not just that easy kind of way of just saying, well, it's someone like me that I don't know. The other big one is, especially because you're pastors in this room, the reality is every list, whether it's the writer of Hebrews, whether it's Paul to Timothy or Titus, whether it's Peter and 2 Peter, when there's a list of the characteristics that pastors, that leaders, not just followers of Jesus, but those of us who are leading for Jesus, should be marked by, the one that is consistently mentioned in all of the list is hospitality. Those of us like myself who are extroverts, many times people say, oh, you have the spiritual gift of hospitality because our spare bedroom is always filled with some random person. Anytime there's a World Cup party or a Super Bowl party, we host it at our house. Like for Christmas, we had like over 40 people and they weren't family members in our home. So you're like, oh, that's hospitality. No, that's a very lowered expectation. Hospitality is philoxenos, philo, love, xenos, immigrants. Biblical hospitality is this radical characteristic that we as pastors should be known by, is how we love immigrants, how we welcome the foreigner. And what makes that so radical is even in the first century, the second, third century, and all the way till today, that is a distinguishing mark that is very radical. Like loving people like you, having your in-laws in your spare bedroom, that takes sometimes a little bit of action of the Holy Spirit. But being someone that's identified by how you welcome and love foreigners in the world that we live in today is something that is living a questionable life. That people will say, well, why are you doing that? And it gives us a chance to say, well, the reason why I'm doing that is because Jesus calls me to. The other word that I often use when I talk about a biblical perspective on this is kalao. And that word is, if you remember Philip, the persecution, he goes to Samaria, lots of cool things happen in Samaria. Then the Holy Spirit calls him to the desert road. He meets the Ethiopian eunuch. And the Holy Spirit's call, in the English translation, it usually says, go and walk beside the carriage or the chariot. The Greek is kalao, go and like, kalao is the root for stick like glue. It's like, go and share your life. You know, and I would have loved the picture of like Philip, just radically different than the Ethiopian eunuch, and what it looks like to kalao with someone who is radically different than you and see what the Holy Spirit might do along the way. And so my picture of part of my call is, yes, I'm called the philoxenos, but then I'm also called to kalao with individuals. I can't stick like glue. I can't share my life. I can't build that relationship with everyone who is an immigrant in my community, but I can do it with some. And so more than just kind of knowing their names, I think we are called as followers of Jesus to kalao with people, to really kind of stick with them. So that's just the biblical story. We could talk, if you have questions, a little bit about how those are fleshed out in our church. A little bit more about Logansport, Indiana. Logansport, Indiana is, Cass County is this one here on these maps. All this to say that in 1990, 99, it was actually 99.7% were Anglo in my community. We didn't even have a lot of African Americans. to now today, 2000, we had this steep growth. Even now, 2014 was when this study was done. A third of the population in my city is either an immigrant from Central or South America or a refugee from Southeast Asia. So your community maybe hasn't gone through this radical shift, but it could. Or maybe you're in the middle of it. But there was a time where in my high school, 100% of the graduating classes were English speakers and they were white. And now my son, who's in the third grade, has about, 14 languages spoken from about like 18, 20 countries in a classroom. And it happened like that. It happened just so quick. And once again, if you notice, like we're not, those of you that, I mean, we're not in Indianapolis. We're not in the Chicagoland area. We're like in this is all farmland, right? Corn, soybeans. For us, it's pigs. We do a lot of pigs. And so because we have three major pork processing plants, that was a great place for immigrants and refugees to get work. And so we had this just huge boom where a community changed radically. The church I came to a little over 7 years ago now was an Anglo church. It was in decline. The average age of the people was over 65 years old. And so the community radically changed, but the church didn't flourish in that change because it was new and it was different. It was a different context in a different environment. Now the church, I'm not very capable as a leader, but one of the best environments to be in is if the end goal is that a church closes, there's really not a lot you can do wrong. Like if that's the goal, it's like, well, I guess I can really try anything, right? Because what's the worst that could happen? It closes. Like, oh, okay. And so we kind of went all in to what it would look like to be multilingual and multicultural. And so we started having service in both languages, English and Spanish. We started singing real Latino worship music, not Hillsong Spanish, but like Latino worship music where our white folk didn't know the tune. And we started just trying to say, what would it look like if the goal we had in our church was that everyone that attended would be uncomfortable, which is a terrible idea. But once again, if all that you got is like the church could close, you can go with things like that. And so we grew the church from about 17 or so down to about like 5. And now it's grown, and we have over 80 people that worship on a given Sunday, about 160 people that come about once a month because how attendance works in church today. And we have people like last Sunday, we had people from the United States and Mexico and Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Colombia, Brazil, Dominican Republic. And uniquely, this is the way Tyson sometimes works. They go after a certain ethnic group. And so in the past 2 months, we've had 60 Haitian families move from Miami to my community. And so now we have Haitian families that attend our church, which is throwing a whole new idea. And like, do we do English, Spanish, and Creole? Like, how do we do? I don't know. Anyone that has ideas on that, let me know after. But needless to say, now our church mirrors our community. We lead in our community. We practice immigration law, so we have served over 1,500 immigrants from 87 countries at our legal office. The mayor and city council host their meetings at our church because we are the place where we're like the only place in town that like there is equity. And so because of that, we've just been able to lead a city of around 20,000 in a pretty dynamic way. So I guess I did fail on the fact that the church didn't close, but it's just this really fun, vibrant community that we get to be a part of. So a few things I've learned along the way, just personally, and this is just me and your story might be different. But one of the things I learned was that as a white male with privilege and power, I could always stay in places where I was comfortable. I'm able to do that. I could always stay with people who were like me, who had my point of view. And it isn't until that we actually start interacting with other people that we have to actually expand our perspective and leave our ethnocentric enculturated selves. And if you hear that, don't hear everyone is ethnocentric. I mean, we are raised to understand that the way I do things are the right way. When I teach, I usually have people peel bananas. And if you've never done that exercise, it's quite unique to be in a small group and say, come up with instructions of how to peel a banana. And all of us, like, no, our parents didn't sit us down and, like, say, here's step one, step two. We just kind of learned how to do it because we were enculturated. And the reality is most of us peel a banana the wrong way. Like, if you've ever lived in a banana-producing country, I used to live in the South Pacific, like, the reality is what we would consider the top of the banana, if you will, that has that little stem, most of them would consider the handle. And the reality is you peel the end where the spiders sometimes lay their eggs, so you don't eat that end, so you peel the bottom. And yet, like, I never thought about that until I lived there and had three-year-olds laughing at me in the South Pacific. And I'm like, why are you laughing? You're doing it all wrong. And it's like, the reality is we're all taught a certain way. And we all, if we stay in our own lane, we never have to deal with any other perspectives. Having befriended people who are different, who are immigrants and refugees, it has expanded who I am as a person. I have grown far more than I ever could. I understand who Jesus is far more. I understand what the family of God is far more because it radically changed my perspective on lots of things. Immigrant friendships, if you haven't developed any, will open up entire networks that you didn't know existed in your community. I'd only been at our church for a couple months, and Estella Soriano said, there's a lady who's my friend, whose husband is in the hospital, and so since I attend your church, you're his pastor too. And I didn't understand how that worked, because that's not how it worked in my world, but I said, okay, so what do I have to do? And she said, well, you need to visit him in the hospital. And so I met Heriberto Ortiz, and through meeting Heriberto Ortiz, I met literally to date probably over 350 other immigrants in my community. Because Heriberto was the first person from the state of Michoacán in Mexico to find that there were jobs in Logansport. And now there are over like 2,000 people from that state of Mexico that live in Logansport. And they all know Heriberto. So through meeting one person, I met all these other people. And it was uncomfortable because I walked into, I don't speak Spanish, which surprises a lot of people, but I walked into a hospital room to do a visitation with someone who was only spoke Spanish, and in the room were like dozens of other people who only spoke Spanish, and like, I don't know what I'm doing here. It's like, I just came to close the church. What am I in this room for? But like, through that one relationship, it opened up so many, and you guys know that, like, you'll have a friend who's Indian, then all of a sudden people will come by and it's like they know that because you love their friend, you'll love them. And then all of a sudden you're invited into this whole world that at least for me, I didn't even know existed. And that has happened time and time again with the new Haitian families. It was like Haitians stopped by our church and they said, hey, we have a moving truck. Can we put it in your parking lot? And we're like, sure. And we started talking. And they saw Wesleyan Life magazine, and she's like, well, that's my church. And I said, well, that's who we are, too. And she got really excited, and now every other Haitian that comes, like, has to come to our church because she befriended us, and now she has opened us up to all these other networks as well. The other thing I've learned is that immigrant friendships, refugee friendships, at least in my own experience, are far deeper. Because they are founded, instead of, like, homogeneous friendships, when we have all this shared likeness, sometimes don't get that deep because they don't need to. But when you have a friend, when you build relationships with people who are radically different than you, the stress and the discomfort that that relationship is founded on usually means it's far deeper. So when I go through hardships in my life or my marriage, like, I have a lot of friends who are like me, and they're great, but I'll call someone like Luigi Peñaranda, who's different than me, or Nico Laurent, who's different, because, like, our relationships have been through more because they've been tested under the stress of the tension of kind of this cultural dissonance. The other thing that's helped me just as a follower of Jesus is you understand all these differences. I'm trying to think of even one to share. So, anytime Isaac has, I have a 9-year-old son, and he'll have, all of his friends are just kids who are immigrants, and so he'll have them over, And what's unique to me is, you know, our plumbing can handle, like, toilet paper now. But most places in the world, if you've ever gone there, even on vacation, you know, you put toilet paper next to the toilet in the trash can. And so most of the kids that visit our house, like, we always got to remember to take out the trash because, like that's what happens. And so I was talking, we also opened a coffee shop in our church, and so I was talking to Abby because she's the older sister of her brothers are my son's friends. And I'm like, hey, what's with this? Like, why don't, like, you know that you can flush toilet paper. She's 23 years old. She's lived here since she was 2. And she's like, no, you can't. And I'm like, Abby, let me just tell you, if you've never known this. I'm like, yes, you want to do that. Like, why would you ever throw it away? And she looked at me with a straight face, said, well, why wouldn't you throw out your trash twice a day? And I thought, well, I guess it wouldn't be a big deal if I threw out my trash twice a day, no matter where the... But, like, for me, it was, like, these differences that, like, I think one of the things we have to learn is, like, it's not wrong or right, it's difference. There are categories that are wrong and right. There are. But they're pretty thin. There's a pretty wide category that's difference. So I learned these fascinating differences, but then these surprising likenesses. I have more in common as a follower of Jesus with Nico than my own brother. And so sometimes when you go on these journeys, and those of us that are in places of power and privilege, I think we learn a lot about what the kingdom of God is like. Because the kingdom of God is this inverted structure where the first is last and the last is first. So I learned far more from Nico about what that looks like than I could ever learn from, like, my other kind of white male friends. And so it's really just helped me in a lot of those ways. Just a couple more things. These are just the things, if I had to kind of put them all on one slide, that have been helpful for me. I think if you're looking for a gauge of what the depth of a relationship is like with an immigrant, this is from a white male perspective, it's comfort. If you are comfortable, I do coaching with a lot of pastors who are moving churches to multi-ethnic, and if they have never felt uncomfortable, I hesitate to think that the relationships are authentic. Because there has to be some discomfort there. Without fail, the services I think went best on Sunday morning, Nico will tell me were the worst for him. Because I like them, because I liked all the songs we chose, and I liked how that all landed. And the ones that I get most uncomfortable with, thinking like, oh, there were guests here this morning that were white, I bet they really... Nico's like, wasn't that a great service, Pastor? And I'm like, for real? Like, no, like, we did so much in Spanish, and we never translated in English, and people were probably lost, and... So discomfort isn't a bad thing. And as white folk in the room, I think sometimes if there is discomfort, we get defensive, which is, I think, what the enemy wants us to do, instead of just taking the posture of a humble learner and saying, I have some place to grow here, and it might grow through pain or brokenness, because our hearts are right a lot of the time, so we still make a ton of mistakes. Luigi's not here, so I'm going to keep picking on him. Courtney, don't tell him. But Luigi has been a great friend. Luigi Pignanata teaches at Wesley Seminary, and we got to meet them, I don't know how, a number of years ago. And Luigi has been a great friend because when I think I've knocked it out of the park, he humbles me and lets me know that, like, well, here were the areas that you didn't do that very well. But when I beat myself up, Luigi has always come alongside me and said, Zach, but your heart was right. Like, you don't kill yourself because you did this completely wrong culturally, and it was kind of offensive to us Latinos in the room. Like don't give up. Keep trying, even though you keep falling down along the way. And having a friend like that will keep those tensions, like when you think you did great and you've built this great multi-ethnic church, to have a friend that says, it's multicolored, but it's not really multicultural, that hurts. But you need that. And likewise, when you want to give up and think, man, it was just easier to just hang out with all the kinds of people that are like me, who think like me, for them to kind of say, no, like, you need to do more. I'll share this briefly. This has been extremely helpful for me recently. Santis gave me these terms, and I think they came from a book, and I don't know the author. But I think when it comes to exploring cross-cultural relationships, there are people who are in the base. So I'm just going to use like someone from Mexico, for example. Someone in the base would probably be Spanish only, have a lot of first-generation immigrant friends, be very proud to be Latino and Mexican, wouldn't have a lot of relationships that are with like white culture, majority culture. On the other hand, there are people on the border. And as church people, we love these people. Because even though they look different, they're very similar to us. We can place them on our boards and they know English well. They think like we do. And so we think we've made this huge win because we're like, look at our board. We have this person from Mexico and Dominican Republic and India on our board. But yet, they've kind of crossed over. And culturally, they're very much like us. So there isn't a lot of discomfort and we like it. But they're separate from the base. Like sometimes we like it. I'm just going to speak personally as a white male because they'll offer the same critiques of their group that I would. Pastor, I understand those people never show up on time. Yeah, I get it. You know, they just don't give financially. And so you're just going to have to try to know. And so they'll say the things that we think, but we never verbalize. And since they verbalize it for us, we're like, oh yeah, that's what I thought. And there's a place for border people, but if you're expecting border people to help draw in the base, it's probably never going to happen because culturally they've assimilated for whatever reason. There's lots of reasons this could happen. But if those are the people that you're promoting to be like the assistant pastor on the board, it's not a bad thing. But if you're expecting them to speak culturally, they're probably not going to. Then there's the bridge, and there are these people that like still are connected to the base, still authentic. Oh, by the way, and you know, if you have authentic relationships with immigrants, like in my community, for instance, there's a gentleman who is an executive in Tyson, and his father was from Mexico, and so the Chamber of Commerce and the City Council and every board has him on it, and they love having him on it, and they're always like, Zach, look, we put him on the board. And yet every Latino in our community is like, oh, he's not one of us. He doesn't speak for us. He doesn't even know Spanish. And you'll hear those things. And those, at least for me now, are triggers not to condemn the person. I think he's a wonderful person. But expecting him to do what someone in the base will do is just dynamically different. And so I think for me, at least, this helped to say, how many of my friends that are people of color, especially immigrants and refugees, would I say are border? That they're my friend and I feel good about it because it's like, well, he's from India, but really they're never pushing me or my perspective. They're never questioning because culturally they're very much like me. And so I'm comfortable and I'm not really being stretched. Still be friends with them. Just don't expect them to be any of these other categories. The category that I think is the most unique to find, and every church hopefully can find someone like this, is the bridge that has the foot in both worlds, that is still loving and respecting who they are as, you know, like a Mexican-American, but yet can speak in to the majority culture and question it when need be. And so those people that have a foot in both, and that's hard. I don't understand fully, but I would understand why it's much easier to be in the base or the border, because when you're in that in-between, you're getting pushed by both. And yet, those are the people, and we'll see it more, especially if you serve within Latino populations, like this 1.5 generation could do so much for our churches, because they can speak and challenge the first generation immigrant church, but yet speak and challenge our multicolored kind of multi-ethnic movement as well, and say that's not enough. And having people like that, at least for me, finding people in the bridge has been really important. I already talked about not right or wrong, but difference. All of you kind of know, especially if you're going to do ministry with immigrants and refugees and you're white, there are so many unspoken expectations. I did not realize the role of the pastor was to go to like third cousins' birthday parties that I've never seen before. But I've realized more and more that, like, once again, not right or wrong, but different. It's like if I'm going to pastor this church, it means that I should stop over and have coffee, which ends up being 2 hours long. And even though I don't understand why I should go because I don't understand Spanish fully, like, I'm like, Nico, you go. And he goes like, you're the pastor. Like, you need to be there. Like, there's something about your presence. And so language, like sometimes there's things that are unspoken, like even in our language, things that you have to read between the line. For me, powerful crossing thresholds. I love that, at least in the Greek, when Peter visits Cornelius, it repeats it twice in the same verse that he entered in. I think so often at the bridge, if I can be critical of my local church, we pat ourselves in the back because we worship together, and that's powerful. It's more powerful to share a table together. And so a lot of our churches, as we move into this, the question becomes, are you breaking down societal and social barriers? And that is much more readily happening over food and eating and tables than any other way. So I'm constantly pushing and saying, how many homes have I entered? How many people have I invited into my home? Because that is where sometimes Jesus works the most. I've learned this a lot. I'm a white male. I speak for a living. And so I serve a lot of immigrants and have immigrant friends. And if I'm honest, I have felt at times I can share your story better than you can. And so I love the proverb that talks about being a voice for the voiceless. My good friend Nico pulled me aside once and said, Zach, I have a voice and you're just not listening. I think that's a word for some of us in the room. I think empowering immigrant voices, allowing immigrants and refugees to share their own story, giving them the platform. I say this as I have the mic. We need to do a better job of that. Our movement needs to do a better job. Our churches need to do a better job of that. We will consider it a win when we do a combined service, but we're in charge of it. What does it mean for us to submit and say, I'm going to place myself under the leadership of the other? And even if the service doesn't go because it's not going to be planned out like we're comfortable with, it's still going to be great because we have placed ourselves in that position. That's an equity thing, not an equality thing. The parable of the workers is a great one. I don't know where, if you are in a community where immigrant day laborers gather, ours it's at Home Depot for construction. If you're a foreman, you drive your pickup truck up and you take a look and culturally you think who's the strongest, like who are the ones that seem the best, and that's who you bring. And then if the roofing job gets harder, you go back and hopefully there's still some people there and you take the next and the next and the next. And so the last people you would ever bring on board were the ones that are kind of the lowest of the rung. And when they're paid at the end of the day, you know that parable, it isn't equally, it's equitably. It's saying the kingdom perspective is not saying how does everyone get an equal share. It's how does everyone get the share that they need for mutuality and kinship in the kingdom. What we want to do, I think, at least what I want to do as a white male is say, oh, what it should be is a round table where everyone has an equal voice. And what I'm learning in Scripture is it's an oval table with a head and a foot. And people on the margins are at the head, and those people like myself of power and privilege are at the foot. It's the first and the last thing. Social scientists have said that any time an organization, including churches, pushes for equality when it comes to cultural dynamics, what happens is whatever the societal hierarchy is comes back. And you guys know what that's like. You'll diversify your board, but things don't really change. Because no matter how much I want to say, well, I'll have an equal voice with Nico, the way it works is if I have an equal voice with Nico, I always get my way. Like the only way that this works is if I sit at the foot of the table and listen and learn and allow to be led by those at the bottom. And so that's been hard for me. That's been a dynamic change in our church of like how we have to run meetings and do boards because I realized that when I pushed for equality, it was great for me because I always won. But if I actually wanted us to be multi-ethnic, we'd have to do things different and it wouldn't just always look that equal. This is the last thing and then we'll kind of take questions and kind of share. If these were action items, and I tried to keep it short, but I couldn't. Become aware. I see welcome, and I have cards up here. If you forget that I, the letter I, then the letter C, then welcome.org is where all of the Immigrant Connection resources are now. For the number of years, we have focused on launching legal offices. We have 18 around the nation, and if you want to open an immigration legal office, we need literally hundreds, thousands more because there's such a huge need to help immigrants and refugees with this, the legal kind of intricacies of immigration law. We also realize that a lot of Wesleyan churches, that's jumping off the deep end, and maybe that isn't the place yet. And so if you click on resources on immigrant or icwelcome.org, There's awareness resources. In fact, if you just email me, I'll give them to you so you don't have to do the work. But we can study your community and tell you exactly what the demographics look like. That's hard with immigrants and refugees because, like, sometimes when a random person knocks on your door, you're not ready to open it. But we can kind of say that you realize there are, like, 8,000 Vietnamese that live within 5 miles of your church, or there's this many. And so we can kind of help you understand, here are the immigrants and refugees around you. Here's the language they speak. Here maybe are some of the felt needs. So if you haven't already done that in your community, I would encourage you to become aware just what is happening. Because in my community, it's really easy for people to say, well, we're 100% white because we were 15 years ago. But now it's like when I tell people 1 in 3 people in our community is an immigrant or from an immigrant family, they get shocked because they've seen the change and they had no idea it was 1 in 3. Become educated. I hope. I went to school to become a missionary, and so most of my training is anthropology and intercultural studies, so I didn't understand the unwritten rules that, like, pastors weren't supposed to talk about certain issues in church. So I'm always talking about those issues. So immigration is like a hot button issue, but in our church we talk about it all the time. But what we found, Lifeway just did a study for World Relief and Immigrant Connection a few years ago, was that 9 out of 10 followers of Jesus have never heard a sermon on immigrants, even though it's all over Scripture. We want to help you do that. We have small group resources that are free that you can look at, like a 6-session small group resource that walks through really simple. It's not like reading a huge book. All the sessions are just a few pages long. They have questions and activities. But if you want to walk your church to become, like, more welcoming and understanding of what's happening, especially in our nation where this is an issue that I know, like, a lot of people have come up to me. Yesterday I was wearing the shirt that says, immigrants are a blessing, not a burden. And just as many people came up and said, I love that shirt, said, Zach, if I wore that shirt at my church, I would be, and whatever it was, like excommunicated, tarred and feathered, like all these things that would happen to them. So just if you want to move people along, we have Kyle Ray preached a really great sermon, which isn't shocking at all. He always preaches great sermons, but he preached a really good one on immigration a couple years ago. We have that up on the website. Other ones as well. And so, like, we would love to help you educate others just on Jesus's version, because when we ask people how they formulated their version on immigrants and immigration, less than 1% said the Bible. And so it was like my friends, national news, social media, it was all these other things. We want to help people say, first and foremost, my views are shaped by the Bible. This is a big one. If you do nothing else on this list, Lindy and I, my wife, we try to say, we kind of call it the last five. The last 5 books I've read, are they all authored by white men from the United States? You know, the last 5 people I've had over my house and sat down for a meal are, and so we just kind of say last 5 movies, last 5 albums. Like, is there diversity in that? Because hearing other voices saying, like, the next book I read, I want it to come from a Latino woman. I want to hear that perspective. And whatever it might be, whatever topic it might be, I think that's powerful, and that has a chance to, like, broaden who we are. It's like, I get bothered when Nico's family comes over and we have to put subtitles on. And it's like every movie he watches, he does with subtitles. I can watch 1 in 5 that has subtitles and learn what that experience looks like to have to read and not just listen. Learn someone else's story. Like, I think that's one of the best first steps when people ask. It's like, there are probably someone at your kid's school or someone in the neighborhood or a pastor that's just planted a church in another language that you can say, can we just have coffee? And I just want to listen. I don't want to tell you about all the things our church is doing or, like, why we came here. I just want to listen to your story. It's pretty powerful. We do this. We've hosted this. Our state leaders in education came to our church, and we host a session where they listen to Burmese refugees. And it was powerful for me because I knew some of their stories, but I didn't know all of their stories. And it was powerful for me to hear for the first time some of the experiences they have been through. Amplify immigrant voices. Like I said, I'm sorry that I'm the one up here. I'll continue to do what I can do, but we need to learn how to amplify immigrant voices. Like, maybe even better than preaching a sermon on immigrants is letting an immigrant preach in your church or letting a DACA student tell their story and what they're going through. We need to learn, when we have a place of power and privilege, how to kind of hand that over. we always ask, place yourself under the leadership of the other. I have an Indian brother from Nagaland, and Daisok teaches me more about the Bible than I know anyone else will, because he's just an amazing scholar, and I always tell him, like, I want to just learn from you. And it's been powerful to finally be under the leadership of someone who isn't a white male. Every context, you need to ask yourself where you're located. I can be in a room any time in history, and as a white man, like, I will have a place of power and privilege. My first teaching job was in Bougainville in the South Pacific. I was 22 years old, couldn't grow a beard, still can't really grow a good beard. And my students were either 10 years older than me or as old as 10 years older than my father. They had all already planted, on average, 15 churches. I hadn't even pastored one. And yet I'm in the room as the professor. And so the reality is I have to place myself and understand the differentials, that even though I'm the only young white person in the room in this environment, like, somehow I have the power and privilege, which even when we try, it's like that's just what happens. Realize there's this individual explicit. It's like I hear from so many pastors, well, I don't feel that way. And I know that you individually don't feel that way, but your community might feel a way. And so because the group implicitly feels this way, we have to be aware of that. And we can't let ourselves off the hook to say, well, I've never said that or never done that, as if it isn't happening every single day to our immigrant friends and brothers and sisters. And so just be aware of those things. You can't change everyone, but you can change your sphere of influence. Like, when you're in a conversation and someone constantly wants to identify people as illegals, you're not saying that they're not undocumented or haven't done something wrong, but the reality is, I mean, it's civil law. I have speeding tickets. It's like to dehumanize people and call them that. If you're with your friends and family, it's like you can correct them and say, like, hey, like, undocumented immigrants or people without paper. It's like they're still humans. Like, to try to just say illegals all the time, can we, as a family, at least when you're around me, can you take that? Just like you don't take the Lord's name in vain because I'm a pastor. This is one of those other things that are around me. Can we change this? And so commit to hope in the midst of despair, grace in the midst of all of these flying arrows, reconciliation at all costs. It's hard if you're someone who does this, because in the current climate, it's tough and you want to give up, but don't. Strong, persistent, determined action. Be known by biblical hospitality. Welcome. Practice philoxenos. When I lived in Africa, it always was weird. When I would enter a place, they'd say, you're very welcome. And I'd be like, thank you? Like, what happened? Like, and I realized that in a lot of other cultures, like in our culture, you're welcome is a response to thank you that happens at the end of something. But in a lot of other cultures, in fact, most cultures in the global south, your welcome is like, I'm inviting you in. Like, I want you to know up front that you are welcome here. And it has caught me, like, how do I live that practice in my church, in my community, that as newcomers come, as people on the margins come, that they will feel right from the outset, you are welcome here. We are inviting you in. And we want you here. We think we have something. It's this mutuality. It isn't that they need us, that they are in deficit. They are a great asset. The reality is immigrants resurrected my church. It would be closed now if we kept on that course. But it was immigrants and refugees that allowed us to be who we are. And so the final example I always give is a table. I think there is no more powerful place than the table. And so I think allowing Jesus and you and people who are different than you to surround a table and share life together and eat good food together changes lives. It changes communities. Like, if there's anything you can do, it's like find an immigrant church and don't have a worship service together. Say, like, we're going to put up a ton of tables wherever you can in your sanctuary or fellowship hall. You bring your food, we'll bring our food. And let's just eat together. Like, not all, like, those people here, and they, but like, we'll just share tables, and we'll get to know each other, and we'll fight through all the barriers that the world wants us to divide, because what we have in common is far greater than that. And then personally, as a pastor, like, I don't know what it might look like for you. Maybe it's every 5 or every 15 or once a year or once a month, but try to have someone over that's different than you into your home, crossing a threshold. I almost guarantee, in fact, I have never met an immigrant or refugee that I haven't invited into my home that I'm not invited into their home, and that meal is far better. And it's just amazing, and just those relationships are just really, really powerful. I can give you this. I have cards up here, but icwelcome.org has all of those resources, and my role is just to help. Sometimes it's like listening to pastors as they've gone through things and want to make their church more welcoming. Maybe that's helping your church launch a legal office. Maybe you have a friend who has a legal issue and you don't know where to turn. I get calls from all over the country, and we help people no matter where they are just to kind of either find the closest immigrant connection office or another low-cost office. Or if there isn't any, we'll set up like a web conference call and we'll try to help you through anything like that. Never feel like you're interrupting, or this is what we care about. And we want to be known as people who welcome and love the other. So I have my cards up here. I think we have like 5-10 minutes or so. Any questions? And it doesn't have to be related to this. Like if you have questions related to immigration stuff, I also can do that. Yeah.
I just went on the website and looked for my county.
Uh-huh. Did you go to the IDOD one?
Yeah.
The first one. So IDOD is on demand. And so you actually email George Mason and tell them your county, and they create a report that you want for it. If you want the, so on the awareness list, the first one is a specific research by George Mason students for free. It'll tell you languages, anything you want. They'll research 10 traits in your community. The second one down, if you go to, the Nazarenes have a really good demographic tool that uses American Community Surveys. If you put in the address of your church, the radius you want, and click reports, then click culture, it'll tell you the countries, where people are from, languages spoken. So the second one down can give you it right away. And anyone else that struggles with like those reports, if you just email me, like we can pull a bunch of data for you, because it's just neat to know. Like I wouldn't have known unless these Haitians shown up that like 60 Haitian families in like 2 months have moved. But now I do. So we're glad to help with that. Other questions or thoughts? Yeah. Yeah.
None of us speak Spanish. We still got a Spanish speaking Santa and went down, you know, for Christmas. But we all sat there and they all spoke to each other. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like,
yeah, so I guess a couple of things. One is there's a few places that are usually considered safe, connected places. Churches are one, schools are another. So we usually go to like the schools and say, you know, what's going on? Like how many English language learners do you have? And one of the things that a lot of churches can do easily is a family resource night. Most immigrants, especially migrant workers, will only do things as a family. So doing like conversation only is for adults. They're not going to leave their kids with someone. Like they want to come as a family. So we've hosted these in churches throughout the nation, and families can come. It usually takes one and like saying, kind of talking to teachers and saying, is there one that's really struggling that you think might be willing to come? And the parents, we just kind of try to do some conversational English if they want, or at least let them know of resources like, hey, did you know here's where you get SNAP in our community, or here's the bus route. And the kids, we help with whatever homework they're dealing with. And family resource nights can work really well, even if they're like only in English, because the schools like it, because if you have a bilingual person there, you're almost always going to, just like we do, like I know Luigi speaks English and Spanish. So if I'm in the room, I'm like, well, he'll speak English then. And so the same thing, if you have a Spanish speaker with other, they'll focus on them just speaking Spanish. So sometimes it helps if all you know is English, because it kind of forces the kids to help. So family resource nights, I think, are great and easy. We can help with some of that if you need help with it. With migrant communities, though, sometimes it's very hard for them ever to leave And so it's like, how do we enter into that turf and figure out ways we can serve from within that community? So doing things like you've already done and being okay, because my guess is, and I don't want to speak for them, but even though, I can't, like I said before, like I'll be in a home for 2 hours and we're not communicating, but the presence of just my willingness to be there and have coffee and eat bread with them is pretty powerful. And slowly you might learn the person within that community that might be bilingual and then can help have some conversations and as the kids learn more. So it's seeing if that community is willing to leave, I think, and maybe do a family resource night. And if not, is there something we can do there? And I've never found an immigrant or refugee family that doesn't want their kids to thrive. And for most parts, the first generation has sacrificed for the next generation. And so like Nico would love to help his kids with homework, but he left school in the third grade. So he's like, so can you help? And so if you're willing to say, we want to help your kids thrive, a lot of them, I think, love that. And schools love it too. And so it's put us in neat networks like that. So that's my thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that mutuality of saying, like, we're giving you presents, but, like, you're offering the community, or, like, a lot of times they might make something to give to you, and, like, us being willing to receive it back. It, like, and it's not like, well, no, like, you need that, like, bread, because you probably know. It's like, but when the gift is offered, receiving to show this is mutual, like, we need you just like you need us type thing is important. I learned really quick it made me comfortable to always say no. Like, no, I don't need that. Like, you're fine. You don't have to do this. But, like, especially in a lot of cultures, mutuality, if you don't have that, it creates shame. So for when I'm like, you know, you don't have to do that. Like, I don't need that. It's like learning, like, no, I do. Like, I could really use this help. And so, other questions or thoughts? Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, I think it's being honest, and I think it's one table at a time. I think you'll never change that when it's like that big crowd, but it's like, is it possible that if there's a police officer at your church that they have a meal like with your brother, just with not on the big thing, and just like listen and learn? Because I don't think there's any way to break. I think we want to say, oh, we'll welcome in. We're different. So like, but it's like the fear is real. And rightly so. There are lots of churches I know who have... Like, ICE does not want you calling in to say your neighbor doesn't have papers. Like, they literally, that's not what we're about, even now. But some people feel like that's their role as a Christian. And so I don't think we're ever going to change this other than, like, kind of one table at a time and little by little help. Hopefully, like, our church is known as a very safe place, and so that's fine. But other churches in our community aren't. And so finding, like, trying to break in and have one. And so you don't have to remake the wheel. Like, if there's a church that's already doing this well, it's like maybe, you know, kind of pointing people that way. But I think it's those slow things. I mean, you would know, like, is there ways that, like, it's probably through your experience that some of that fear has broken down, definitely in places, but not in other places. There's probably other places that you're like, I know not to. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, how do you, so, like, yeah, there's the fear that it Mm-hmm. But, you know, still kind of...
Yeah, for sure. So I think it's little by little, and then hopefully in your communities you'll find, because not all of us, have churches, I think, that it's the spectrum. You know, people you know are welcome, and people who aren't, it's like, how do we like work on this end and have a small group, and we're slowly doing something here to kind of change some of that in the hopes that, and the prayers that this other side might change. And so I think it's little by little. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's true.
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, that is so hard. You know, that's a hard place to be in. But maybe the Lord will give you a chance to speak to the white people around you, because a lot of them are afraid, too. Like, the whole problem between races is a place that both are afraid of each other. They're afraid of the unknown. And it's really not about our culture, even, or our color of skin. What it comes down to is good and evil. You're not afraid of a good person. You just don't, when you say see a stranger, you don't know. And anymore, we're afraid of our neighbors, as it seems to be such a lies and evil and fear in general. But I think what people think you talk, I think about, I have a very white church in a very white area. So we are very close to a multicultural area. I come from State College, here at State College, PA, so we have a big college. But, you know, the people, I think people are afraid.
And so tables and dialogue, we have things on the website that actually are, you can do like a one evening dialogue with your church just to talk about this. What's your experience? Even if you have an all white church, what generation immigrant are you? And it kind of walks through and like, what have you learned about that experience? Like in my community, the Italians came to do the canals, the Irish did the railroad. And there are older people in my community who would say, we had the weird religion because they were Catholic. We had the weird smelling food and spoke the weird language. Then when they heard Burmese refugees share the same story about coming to the community, all of a sudden it was like, we know exactly what that was like. And so sometimes dialogue is powerful and we have that. I'm going to let you go, but let me pray real quick. And then if you have other questions, feel free to stick around and share. But let me just pray real quick. Jesus, we thank you so much that you are continually welcoming us in, that you have invited us to your table. My prayer is that everyone in whatever context they are personally might take whatever that next step is, even if it's uncomfortable, to welcome and love the other in their community. I pray for our churches that we will look more and more like the churches you have called us to, that we won't allow culture to make us afraid, but rather we will stand as your people. To be the families you have called us to be, to practice philoxenon, to kala'o with people, and to be radically different. We pray this in your powerful name, Jesus. Amen.